Hello, and welcome to In Conversation With, the Lancet HIV podcast. I am Deputy Editor Adrian Gonzalez, and for our August edition, I am joined by Erin Braley and Mackenzie Braley, two First Nations women co-authoring and co-leading a review published in our August edition that offers the unique perspective that Indigenous people have on the HIV epidemic and interactions between Indigenous identities and HIV. Today, instead of me introducing in detail who they are or where they come from, these authors will take the initiative to introduce themselves as part of an essential protocol within the Indigenous worldviews. But before we get to that, I would like to draw your attention to a couple of other pieces in this month's issue. First, we have a comment exploring the slow uptake and challenges surrounding pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV prevention and discussing the potential of new biomedical prevention modalities like the vaginal ring and the long-acting injectables. We also have a research article exploring how a multi-level dynamic health system intervention improve variolical suppression among adolescents and young adults living with HIV in rural Kenya and Uganda. And a very important article discussing the problems of current systems for HIV prevention and treatment delivery in the USA and outlining future directions to regain lost ground, particularly among priority populations of the Ending the HIV Epidemic Initiative. And now, let's get Erin and Mackenzie. And now I'm joined by Erin Braley and Mackenzie Braley. We're very happy to have you here today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here today. Thank you for having us. My name's Erin. I'm Nagio Isqueo from Sutta Lake Cree Nation from my father's side, and I'm British Irish settler on my mom's side. I live and I work on the territories of the Lekwungen and Wasanich peoples in what is known as Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. I'm an Indigenous public health professional, and I work within our healthcare system in BC to eradicate Indigenous-specific racism and embed cultural safety and cultural humility. So I just want to acknowledge, first of all, that we're a team of scholars based in Canada, and our review and what we will share today is informed by our knowledge and our experiences and relationships to the territories where we are from. And although we call upon knowledge from Indigenous people globally through UNDRIP, the 10-point statement, and the articles published from Indigenous authors globally, we acknowledge that we represent just one perspective and don't represent Indigenous people globally. So with that, I can hand it off to you to introduce yourself, Mackenzie.
Hi, my name is Mackenzie. I am Nahio Cree from my father's side and have European settler ancestry from my mother's side. I'm a member of Sutta Lake Cree Nation in Alberta, Canada. I live on the unceded ancestral and traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Coquitlam peoples, colonially known as Vancouver, Canada. I'm a PhD student in the clinical psychology program at Simon Fraser University, and my work focuses on culturally safe mental and medical health care for Indigenous peoples.
Thank you. Thank you both for this interesting introduction that comes together with the panel within your review that shows the importance of introducing yourself as a protocol within the Indigenous worldviews. My first question is that for Erin. The UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples serves as a framework in your review. Could you explain to our audience what is this declaration and how its principles and message relate to the HIV healthcare in Indigenous peoples?
Yeah, absolutely. So the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, or UNDRIP, is an international instrument adopted by the United Nations in 2007, and it outlines the rights of Indigenous people of the world, as well as the state responsibilities to uphold those rights. And these rights constitute the minimum standard for survival, dignity, and well-being of Indigenous peoples. Since 2007, it has been adopted by 144 countries worldwide. And although it is a non-binding instrument, some states are implementing UNDRIP into their laws. So in Canada, for example, the implementation of UNDRIP became law in 2021 with Bill C-50 and the UNDRIP Act. And although all Indigenous rights are crucial for health and well-being, there are some critical themes related to Indigenous health and wellness, and therefore HIV. So first, UNDRIP states that Indigenous peoples have the right to full health and wellness, and that all states must take steps to progressively achieve the full realization of this right. Second, Indigenous people have the right to their traditional medicines, as well as their cultural identity, and to access fully, without any discrimination, all social and health services. And finally, the Indigenous right to health is also inextricable from the Indigenous right to self-determination. And self-determination in this context refers to control over health and well-being through health programs and governing institutions. The entire suite of rights outlined in UNDRIP, when fulfilled, will set the stage for survival, dignity, and well-being for Indigenous people. But many Indigenous people are denied their basic rights. And so to this day, Indigenous people face socioeconomic disadvantages, a direct result of centuries of rights violations that amplify HIV risk. and we will see lower rates of HIV in Indigenous populations, as well as improved health and wellness journey of Indigenous people living with HIV, with the realization of the rights out in UNDRIP, such as improvements of health and social conditions and accessing culturally safe, racism-free HIV care and Indigenous-led health and wellness services.
Thank you, Erin. Your publication discusses the still ongoing violations of Indigenous rights and their impact on the HIV epidemic. Could you elaborate on how the socioeconomic disadvantages resulting from colonialism contribute to increased HIV risk among Indigenous peoples?
Yeah, so to answer this question, I wanted to take a step back first and provide some context for when we talk about health gaps and disparities in health for Indigenous people. So when we talk about how Indigenous people are at increased risk of HIV and AIDS, the idea or the notion that comes through is that indigeneity is a risk factor for poor health, that there is something inherent about being Indigenous that makes us more likely to have HIV or to suffer from various health risks, when this isn't the case. The risk factor is being subject to colonialism and not being Indigenous. So taking a step back here to 1493 with the Doctrine of Discovery. So this was created by the Pope and gave European explorers the authority to claim any lands that they had discovered, regardless of the Indigenous people who already resided there. The doctrine was used for centuries to justify the seizure of Indigenous land, and settler colonialism as a system was imposed to displace, dehumanize, and eliminate the first people of a territory in order to make room for a new settler population. In Canada, for the purpose of creating new settler society, European settlers had implemented various acts of genocide against Indigenous peoples that were meant to eliminate them. So Indigenous children, for example, were forcibly removed from families and placed into institutions called residential schools, where they were forbidden from practicing their culture and were subject to abuse, malnutrition, and disease. And settler colonial states on Indigenous land, which also includes the United States, New Zealand, Australia, are built upon and maintained by the violation of Indigenous rights. And as a result, all laws and policies within these states, every facet of these states, continue to place Indigenous people at a disadvantage while placing settler populations at an advantage. And colonialism impacts virtually all socioeconomic factors: underemployment, poverty, homelessness, incarceration, violence, which in turn impacts health outcomes. It is well established globally that structural inequalities and human rights barriers substantially increase HIV risk and reduce access to services for both Indigenous populations and other key affected populations. So for example, people in prison are 5 times more likely to be living with HIV than adults in the general population, while Indigenous people in many countries are over-criminalized and overrepresented in the prison population. We know that sex workers are 35 times more likely to have HIV, while Indigenous women, in particular, in many countries turn to sex work for survival amidst inequalities. And people who inject drugs are 35 times more likely to have HIV, while many Indigenous people use substances to cope with intergenerational and ongoing trauma associated with colonialism. So all that said, the risk factor here being colonialism, while indigeneity is a source of strength for Indigenous people and those living with HIV, and it's a state responsibility per UNDRIP to improve the socioeconomic conditions in Indigenous populations, which will require system change.
Thank you, Erin. That was a very enlightening response, very well put. And let's move to Mackenzie now. I would like to ask you about the International Indigenous HIV and AIDS Community, a community that has developed a 10-point statement for advocacy to end HIV and AIDS among Indigenous peoples. In your opinion, what are the key elements of this statement that should be prioritized to achieve meaningful solutions for HIV?
Yeah, so the 10-point statement was developed by Indigenous leaders globally for Indigenous communities to use when they respond to HIV. And so I can't say which statement should be prioritized because it's up to the communities themselves to decide what they need based on their own unique scenarios, different political and socioeconomic environments, different ways of knowing, et cetera. But the governments need to support these communities in these efforts. And so that would involve prioritizing all of these statements and focusing on the statements that they decide is most relevant for them. So I can summarize a few key points from the 10-point statement that is needed to achieve meaningful solutions for HIV and AIDS that Erin hasn't talked about in her answers already. So the first point is that Indigenous peoples are disproportionately impacted by HIV and AIDS. And this needs to be recognized by governments through equity in prevention, treatment, and response programs. So this might look like funding and efforts being focused on those who are most affected. But because a lot more work needs to be done in terms of knowing who is most affected, the 10-point statement calls for Indigenous-led and governed epidemiological research. So which distinct communities require an increased focus, and how do we do this in a good way? And then once we know who is most affected through that research, we can target efforts which need to be Indigenous-led. The 10-point statement calls for Indigenous responses and leadership to ensure that prevention and treatment are administered and are readily available to all in culturally relevant ways, culturally safe ways, based on Indigenous ways of knowing, and without any racism, stigma, or discrimination. And so finally, the 10-point statement calls for commitment and accountability mechanisms. And that's to ensure that we're not just saying that we're going to do all these things, but that we're actually following through with them. So in Canada, for example, we passed a law requiring us to incorporate UNDRIP into all legislation, meaning that Indigenous rights have to be upheld by law. So that's an example of an accountability mechanism that other states can and should be following.
Thank you, Mackenzie. And you also mentioned that Indigenous peoples have an holistic perspective on health and wellness. Can you explain how this affect the experiences of Indigenous people living with HIV?
Yeah, and before answering this question, though, I want to acknowledge that Indigenous peoples globally are really diverse, and their perspectives on HIV and healing are also diverse and will look different for each Indigenous community, even those who are within the colonial bounds of one country. But that being said, the principle of holistic health is common among Indigenous people worldwide. And so although they are diverse, many view health holistically, made up of mental, emotional, spiritual, cultural, and physical elements. And our review showed that cultural aspects such as people's spirituality, connection to the land, knowledge and use of their traditional language were really important for the health and well-being of Indigenous people living with HIV. So being connected with your culture supports your well-being. It helps you to cope. It also makes it more likely that you will adhere to HIV treatments such as antiretroviral therapy. So when an Indigenous person seeks treatment related to HIV, they might not just be seeking physical health care, such as, you know, biomedical treatment, but perhaps also spiritual or cultural healing. So they might want to participate in a ceremony, visit an elder, be in a talking circle, or go through a land-based healing treatment. And this shows the importance of healing beyond just the physical aspects, which is often the only focus in mainstream Western healthcare. And that's one major reason why it doesn't work for Indigenous peoples, and we need these additional spiritual, cultural elements.
Thank you, Mackenzie. I agree that the Western medicine, sometimes we forget about the mental, spiritual part. I mean, yeah, therapy is important. More people should be doing therapy, that's for sure. And also for Mackenzie, your review discusses the importance of integrating biomedical and Indigenous knowledge for HIV as a decolonization approach for HIV prevention and care. Could you provide examples of successful approaches that combine these two knowledge systems?
Yeah, the easiest way to answer this question is by saying that if these approaches existed widely, and if I could give you a bunch of examples of successful approaches, that we wouldn't have to write this paper. So we see such unequal outcomes for Indigenous people because these approaches, unfortunately, are not very common. And so while we've seen significant research that shows that better health outcomes are achieved when healthcare is Indigenous-led and incorporates those additional spiritual elements, there's only a few places that have actually picked this up and put it into practice with HIV specifically. So one example I can think of in Canada is the Communities, Alliances, and Networks organization that provides Indigenous-specific education, support, and empowerment for Indigenous people living with HIV or AIDS. There are other examples, though, outside of HIV care specifically, so just thinking about health in general. One example is the Turtle Lodge in Manitoba, Canada. The Turtle Lodge has a network of partnerships with healthcare providers, elders, healers, and community members to address health in a traditional and sustainable way. It is based on ancestral land-based teachings that bring balance to life and improve health. So, for example, they offer ceremonies and indigenous knowledge teachings for healing. Another example is the South Central Foundation's Nuka System of Care in Alaska, United States. And that's a medical clinic that incorporates traditional indigenous knowledge and cultural services into the healthcare. So they have talking circles, traditional healings, there's healing gardens, etc. And so we know that integrating indigenous knowledge into biomedical healthcare for HIV is needed. We need a lot more programs that actually do this. And this requires a lot of steps before we can achieve that. So number one, we need more funding for communities to implement their own services. We need indigenous knowledge to be respected and actually seen as a valid form of healthcare. We need more research to understand this. And a really important final thing that's needed is eliminating the systemic barriers in the indigenous communities that prevent them from achieving these self-determined and indigenous-led healthcare services.
And I have one last question for Erin. Moving forward, in your own words, what will be the key recommendations that emerge from this review? I mean, what actions should be taken at global, national, community levels to effectively address the HIV epidemic among Indigenous peoples and uphold their rights to health and well-being?
Yeah, one key barrier within the healthcare system is that anti-Indigenous racism is embedded within healthcare systems. And this prevents Indigenous people from accessing healthcare and causes major distrust in the healthcare system. And we call for healthcare services to ensure that Indigenous people feel safe accessing healthcare, can receive high-quality care, be treated with respect, and receive culturally safe and appropriate services. We also call on states to eradicate Indigenous-specific racism from systems and structures that exclude Indigenous people from fully participating in social and economic landscapes and prevent them from self-determination and self-governance. As UNDRIP is not a legally binding instrument, it is up to countries who have signed on to UNDRIP to ensure that their laws and institutions align with UNDRIP. To our knowledge, there are two nation states that have implemented UNDRIP legislation, including Bolivia in 2009 and now Canada in 2021. These countries then have a legal responsibility to pick up this work and uphold Indigenous rights, and we have yet to see other countries take this step. At an international level, Indigenous communities and leaders must have a seat at the table in global efforts to eradicate HIV and AIDS. We see that many Indigenous populations are disproportionately impacted by HIV, but Indigenous people are not identified as a key population by UNAIDS in the goal of ending AIDS as a health threat by 2030. UNAIDS recognizes that not everyone is benefiting equally from prevention, testing, treatment efforts, which means that populations are getting left out, and this includes Indigenous populations. So UNAIDS, its corresponding agencies and member states must recognize Indigenous people as a key population as well as to uphold UNDRIP. And with Indigenous peoples and knowledge as leaders in global efforts, we will see greater progress globally in eradicating AIDS as a global health threat.
Well, thank you very much for both of you for bringing this both interesting and important topic to the to our audience in here in the In Conversation With in the Lighter HIV podcast. And it has been a pleasure to have you here today. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Thanks for having us.
If you would like to know more about this review, you may find it in our already published August issue. And if you find that interesting, you might also like to read an article published in our September issue 2018 on HIV incidence in Indigenous and non-Indigenous populations in Australia that comes with a link comment by Cornelia Women. Or our feature article published in our May issue 2021 on tackling HIV in Peru's Indigenous communities. Well, that's all for the August issue. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen so that you may join us when we continue the conversation. Thank you.